This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
Happy holiday weekend, but not for GM workers. A lot of layoffs planned by the auto giant. Details in a moment. Then President Bush's trip to Asia and the Iraq debate that didn't go away. In Baghdad, CBS News correspondent Cammy McCormick will report on the Iraqi army. If it can handle the insurgents, Americans could leave. And whether it's patriotism or the need for a job,
recruiting stations are full, even though they're attacked regularly.
We'll also hear from CBS News legal analyst Andrew Cohen on Jose Padilla, alleged terrorist. Remember the original allegations touching on a dirty bomb plot?
That he was coming to the United States to engage in some sort of warfare here to kill U.S. citizens. And after 3 years, after confinement, after all these legal challenges to his status as an enemy combatant, we get this.
And a lot more ahead. But first, Detroit's biggest of the big three car companies will shrink to survive. 30,000 jobs being cut. Details from CBS News business correspondent Anthony Mason.
With sales sliding and losses soaring, GM announced sweeping job cuts and plant closings.
This has been a difficult period for all of us at General Motors.
CEO Rick Wagoner told his employees the company's U.S. workforce will be cut by about a quarter over the next 3 years as the world's largest automaker tries to get back on the road to profitability. But job cuts may not be enough for GM. Chubba Chetta of Car and Driver magazine says the company needs to make better cars and trucks.
Fundamentally, GM hasn't been producing the cars and trucks that people really want to buy. And when they push the sales up like they did last summer with the employee discount program, it works great from a sales standpoint, but it doesn't make any money for the company.
GM's good health isn't just important for the auto industry. It's estimated that directly or indirectly, almost 1 million people depend on GM for their jobs. So when General Motors suffers, the symptoms are felt through the entire economy. Anthony Mason, CBS News, New York.
When President Bush returned to Washington late Monday for less than 24 hours here in our nation's capital before Thanksgiving at his ranch in Texas, experts on Asia said they were not impressed by the results of his 8-day journey to Japan, South Korea, China, and Mongolia. That last stop, a former communist country, so friendly with the U.S., CBS's Bill Plant points out Mongolia has 120 troops in Iraq.
Mr. Bush, the first sitting president to visit this remote land, came to return the favor. He compared today's fight against Islamic radicals in Iraq to the fight against communism.
Free people did not falter in the Cold War, and free people will not falter in the war on terror.
The war followed Mr. Bush everywhere on this week-long trip, the more so because there was so little else to talk about. The president wanted Japan to roll back its ban on U.S. beef imports, which may yet happen, but didn't while he was there. Little visible progress was made at the Asian Economic Meeting. And during Mr. Bush's visit, Korea, the host nation, announced plans to bring home a third of its forces in Iraq. In China, the president was received politely, but with no fanfare and only vague promises of action on the big agenda items, the trade surplus, currency value, and intellectual property rights. He explains the U.S.-China connection as a work in progress.
We have a complex relationship, and it's a really important relationship. I mean, China is a big, growing, strong country.
He did have some fun, as CBS News chief White House correspondent John Roberts reported.
President Bush took a break from the diplomacy and daily attacks against his critics back home on Sunday, instead pounding the pedals on what will become the mountain biking course for the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games.
How do you say take it easy on the old man?
The first cyclist headed out for a little friendly competition with Chinese Olympic hopefuls less than half his age.
Let's go.
He actually seemed to enjoy himself.
Just getting warmed up.
But with the heat still on in Washington over his Iraq policy, it wasn't long before the president was drawn back into the competition for political edge. Center stage again, Congressman John Murtha's call to pull troops out of Iraq.
I disagree with his position. An immediate withdrawal of our troops from Iraq will only strengthen the terrorist hand in Iraq.
The president was careful to say he has nothing but respect for the congressman.
Congressman Murtha is a fine man. He's a good man. who served our country with honor and distinction.
The gentle language stood in sharp contrast to an earlier White House attack, comparing Murtha to anti-war filmmaker Michael Moore.
From our White House correspondents who took that long trip to Asia, we turn to a CBS News political consultant, Craig Crawford, author now of a book called Attack the Messenger. Craig Crawford, you say the debate over Iraq is so sharp now because of opinion polls.
Yeah, two dramatic changes in the recent wave of polls, at least half a dozen. And we've all talked about the president's declining popularity and the feeling that he isn't credible, people saying he's not trustworthy. That is a new set of numbers for Bush. It suggests a personal problem that American people have with him that they didn't have before. The other difference is the slippage among moderate Republicans. You're always talking about conservative Republicans, evangelicals. The real base of the party are moderates, which we define as fiscal conservatives and social moderates. And there has been slippage in that group, and that's what's got the Republican Party so worried.
So if the Republicans seem to be in trouble right now, is that definitely good news for the Democrats for the 06 elections?
If they can take advantage of it. You know, Democrats, everything's going Democrats' way except for two things. They don't have a voice and they don't have a message. They need a messenger. They need someone in leadership that the public likes. I think some of the congressional leaders have limited appeal for the Democratic Party. And also a message. What is their message about Iraq, for example? There's an argument within the Democratic Party about an immediate withdrawal, a timetable, no timetable. So the Democrats aren't together on their response to this situation.
And you write, say in your book, Attack the Messenger, that often the status of the news media is also there in the debate. Members of the administration sometimes blame the news and the headlines for, in part, turning the public against the war.
Yeah, and Vice President Cheney's recent speech, he started that speech, his big defense of the war, attacking the messenger, blaming a wire service headline for seeming to imply that the feeling that the administration had become more partisan in its attacks came from the media overblowing the story somehow.
I do have a quarrel with that headline. I do not believe it is wrong to criticize the war on terror or any aspect thereof. Disagreement, argument, and debate are the essence of democracy.
This at a time that the news media are not very trusted either in the opinion polls.
Yeah, it works attacking the messenger because there's a receptivity out there in the public to do that. You know, I remember in the old days when I was a kid watching news shows with my parents and you'd see a politician dodge a question. We'd say, hey, he didn't answer that question. What's the answer to that question? Now you're more likely to hear people say, what a rude question. What's wrong with that reporter? What is he, liberal, conservative? The focus on the messenger, and this is what politicians have managed to do, is make the media the issue and distract the public from things they don't want to talk about.
Craig Crawford, who analyzes politics for us at CBS News and author of a book called Attack the Messenger, How Politicians Turn You Against the Media. Up next, we go to Iraq.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Thanksgiving time, feeling full? Some weighty thoughts from our commentator, Charles Grodin.
This is from the New York Times. Evidently, there's some new hormone researchers have just discovered that sharply reduces the desire to eat. A new hormone. So far, they've tried it on mice, and it evidently sends a signal to the mouse's brain that says, eat less, and the mouse eats less. The scientists at Stanford University discovered it. It's evidently made in the stomach and the small intestine. I'm certain you have to go to medical school to know how you spot it or get it down there in the small intestine. Mice given the hormone for 8 days ate half as much as usual. It apparently slows the passage of food through the stomach, of course slowing down when you might next feel hungry. This has only been tested on mice, but drug companies are scrambling to come up with a way to get it to humans since our obesity rates are skyrocketing. An obesity researcher from the University of Washington said the chances that this is going to hold up in humans is very high. However, another obesity expert from the University of Cincinnati says the effect of body weight seems to be subtle. He means the mouse's body weight. Not only that, but the mice might be losing muscle weight, and that's not good. If we could get a pill that would make us eat less without our left arm eventually falling off, that would be good. I'm sure we could get a pill for everything, but when you read the potential side effects for just about everything we might take, it has to give you pause. I'm told drug companies have to report something even if it happened once, but we're not told that. Just what could happen, not the odds it will. I want to hear the odds, otherwise I'm not taking it. Of course, the mice don't get to read the side effects or the odds. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Now to a superstar of American literature, Kurt Vonnegut. He turned 83 this month. He's got a new book, and CBS's Bill Vitka discovered Vonnegut loves music.
Ink on paper isn't the way to tell a story anymore.
Take a ride with author Kurt Vonnegut to places that conquer space and time, threading the conventions of science fiction with the human drama. Science fiction lends itself to Vonnegut's universe, at once random and irrational, but in which wonder has a place, ingredients that are essential to the telling of his landmark story, Slaughterhouse-Five, about his own experience during World War II as a POW.
Boom, boom, boom. I'm gonna shoot you right down.
Vonnegut was 23 when he was captured at the Battle of the Bulge. His division overrun, and the order to surrender came down.
We didn't think that was a very good idea. We didn't think the Germans were really very nice people, so we decided to keep on going.
Then suddenly the Germans were on bullhorns telling you to give up, right?
They had a bullhorn of some kind and said, "We know where you are, is come out." We didn't do anything, and so they fired some tree bursts over us, and we decided maybe they had a point after all.
Vonnegut was imprisoned in Dresden. It was there beginning February 13, 1945, where the Allies firebombed and destroyed a city of no military significance.
We were lucky to be quartered in a slaughterhouse anyway, where there were meat lockers under the street, which turned out to be very good air raid shelter. It was the British who burned down Dresden, and they did that at night. And then American planes would come over in the daytime and drop high explosives to discourage the firemen.
You said you had to grow up before you could write Slaughterhouse-Five, before you could write that story.
I had to become truthful.
It took Vonnegut 24 years to get there. The book he wrote, though, was not the idea that he began with. The original plan, needing to feed his family, was to write a funny war story, have it made into a movie, and in his mind's eye, Vonnegut was already casting roles.
Maybe with Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. And I visited this my war buddy, Bernie O'Hare, to help me remember, you know, funny stuff, be good in the movie. And his wife, Mary, blew her stack. She said, "You were just babies then." I had to confront the truth of that, and finally wrote as truthful a book, as mature a book as I could.
Vonnegut is the author of a new work, a collection of essays called Man Without a Country, joining more than 20 books, including Mother Night, Cat's Cradle, and The Sirens of Titan. For a man who often delves into the lexicon of science fiction, the future is what he believes mankind doesn't have, but he also believes there are nurturing properties to being alive.
The only proof of the existence of God I need is music.
So music is as close to divinity as we can find
it
ourselves.
Yes, yes. I have said, you know, a function of the arts is to make people like life more than they had before, and then I'm asked if I'd ever seen the arts do this, and I said, yes. I said, the Beatles did it.
You are a particular admirer of the blues.
Yes, again, because they work. And how they work, I don't know. But Al Murray, who's a jazz historian, told me, per capita, the slave owners had a much higher suicide rate than the slaves. And he thought this was because the slaves had a way of dealing with depression, and it was the blues.
I live the life I love, and I live the life I live.
Why the name of the book, Man Without a Country?
What the United States I love so much, had such high hopes, and in such large measure has disappeared. The dreams I had for this country have not come true.
You say you know few people today dreaming of a world for their grandchildren.
That's right.
You have grandchildren.
And I'm very sorry about what a terrible planet we've prepared for them.
People are crazy, times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
In Man Without a Country, Vonnegut says he's been writing a novel where, against the backdrop of the end of the world, we meet a stand-up comedian.
There's good news and bad news tonight, friends and neighbors. The bad news is that the Martians have landed in Manhattan and they've checked in at the Waldorf. The good news is that they only eat homeless people of all colors.
So are you writing that book?
No. For one thing, I'm old. I'm pretty much written out.
Faith alongside despair. Not the only seeming contradictions, because after pledging that he has written his last, this unclassifiable American original finds himself with a bestseller.
Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Bill Fitka.
Louis Armstrong and Louis Jordan among the music greats you heard. And if you like MP3 downloads, search for Weekend Roundup. You'll find this broadcast, certainly at cbsnews.com. Get us on the internet, and please stay tuned to this radio station. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein. This is the CBS Radio Network.